From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Delta is hitting the same parts of southwest Louisiana that Hurricane Laura did just 6 weeks ago. It's the 25th named storm of this Atlantic hurricane season, and it's packing 100-mile-per-hour winds and potentially life-threatening storm surges. The National Hurricane Center says the storm is expected to weaken ahead of landfall, but it will still be a dangerous storm. Tony Guillory is president of the Calcasieu Parish Police Jury in Lake Charles, Louisiana. That's the local governing body, like a city council. And Tony is staying at a hotel outside of the danger zone. We caught up with him earlier on his cell phone as he was checking on the condition of his home.
Well, they put tarp over the house, but and I'm looking at it right now. There are some places where rain is still coming in. It's raining. It's not raining hard. It's a constant rain. I think we got 100% chance of rain all day, but right now it's just raining. So I know a lot of houses out here, you know, is going to have the same issue today with water still coming in from the rain.
When is landfall expected?
Between 5 and 7 this afternoon.
Okay. You mentioned that you've put tarps over your house. How else have you prepared for this storm?
You know, you never know. You always think you're prepared. The guys came out and put tarp over the house and to protect a few things that, you know, that it had, because I had one of my walls that blew out, and so it off-shifted the house. So you can never be fully prepared for a storm, because you never know what's going to happen. Each one have their own category of what's going to happen.
Yeah, and I know that you've been through quite a few. Has there been an evacuation order? Did people leave on their own?
We've made a mandatory evacuation as of yesterday.
What is your biggest concern today?
A lot of people got out. Hopefully a lot of people got out, because those that didn't get out don't know if something has happened, if we can get to them. So the biggest concern is that people's safety, that they got out. That's my concern.
Yeah. We spoke with you during Laura, and as we know, that was a really big storm. Is your area still dealing with the aftermath?
Yes, we're still dealing with it. We still have debris on the road. And one of the things, too, also, we have debris that is in a lot of our ditches and on the roadway, so it's going to cause some flooding. So that's another issue right there altogether. But that's something else we're dealing with right there.
You mentioned flooding. How worried are you about a storm surge?
Well, I don't think the storm surge is going to come in too bad. We're not going to have too bad. The flooding, I mean, is from the filling up the ditches, because we have a lot of trees and debris in the ditches. And I'm worried about, as the wind come in, we have a lot of things that are to the road, and it's going to cause a lot of things, a lot of loose things to fly around. So that's one of the dangerous things about being out here, and we're asking everybody to leave.
I know you're used to storms where you live there on the Gulf Coast, but people must be really tired of what's happening this year.
Oh, it's been a rough one. We just missed another one that almost came here, and it made a turn. At the last minute, made a turn. So this year is a very rough one.
Yeah. What's your message to your neighbors and others who you're also concerned about, hoping that they get out in time?
Well, I hope everybody got out, and those that are listening, because I know a lot of your listeners are from different places. I just don't want everybody to forget about Calcasieu Parish, Lake Charles, and the whole Calcasieu Parish, because usually after a storm passes and leaves, everybody forgets about it. We are still dealing with a lot of issues out here. We just got electricity back maybe a week ago, something like that. So we're still dealing with a lot of issues, and if this comes through and knock out electricity, we'll be out electricity again, and our internet is not up. So it's a lot of issues we're dealing with. We just prayers goes out for everyone that's in the way of the storm, and I just ask you all not to forget about us.
Tony Guillory is president of the Calcasieu Parish Police Jury in Lake Charles, Louisiana. Tony, thank you, and please stay safe.
Thank you. And prayers and everything. We ask for everybody prayers as we go through this again.
Well, today the announcement came that this year's Nobel Peace Prize goes to the World Food Program. The Norwegian Nobel Committee praised the United Nations agency this morning for fighting hunger and food insecurity around the globe.
In the face of the pandemic, the World Food Program has demonstrated an impressive ability to intensify its efforts. As the organization itself has stated, until the day we have a vaccine, food is the best vaccine against chaos.
For more, we're joined now by Matthew Hollingsworth. He is the World Food Program's country director in South Sudan, and he joins us now on Skype from Juba. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, and tell our listeners who might not be familiar with the World Food Program's work, what you do around the world and specifically where you are in South Sudan.
So, I mean, the World Food Program is present in a little over 80 countries worldwide, and we feed around 85 million people a year in some of the most vulnerable, poor, and difficult countries in the world, where people are affected by conflict, where they're affected by natural disasters, in places where, you know, hunger is a reality for most families. Here in South Sudan, we feed around 5 million people a year in various programs, emergency programs, where we give food assistance to the most vulnerable people in South Sudan, but also school meals to keep children in school. We support nutrition activities for young children to stave off and prevent malnutrition. And we do a lot of work now to support farmers and rural communities to really build their resilience, to expand their productive land, to grow more so they can feed more of their community. And we support people in urban areas to give them a livelihood, to give them a job, to train them so that they don't need to be dependent on any kind of food assistance.
Well, and I know that before you were stationed there in South Sudan, you were in Syria. Just give us an example of someone that sticks in your mind that, that has been a recipient of food from the World Food Program.
There are so many. I've now worked for the World Food Program since 2001. You typically remember the children you've supported, and you've watched really desperate mothers urging the international community or the World Food Program to support them to make their child healthy, to make their child grow. Going into clinics and working with NGO partners to do that, and seeing children, you know, after a week or more of support, really starting to flourish and do well. I mean, that's probably the best thing you'll ever see. But sadly, we also see, a lot of children suffer. When you can see people pulling through and doing better, that for me is why we do this.
Obviously, the pandemic has had a big impact on hunger around the world, even in this country, that, you know, the food lines have gotten much longer than they usually are. How has the pandemic affected your work, and what do you think you're going to need in the years ahead?
I mean, in South Sudan, we've not seen as yet a very significant health crisis because of the pandemic. But then again, South Sudan is a country that already has so many health crises to deal with, whether it's malaria, measles, or malnutrition. But what we have seen is a significant increase in prices of commodities because supply chains globally, but also regionally, have been tested by the COVID-19 crisis. All prices have increased. The economy of South Sudan, which is dependent on oil prices, has seen a dip. And at the time when food prices are going up, you know, you've seen people, you know, who are already suffering because of many years of civil war, that have had consecutive years of flooding, that are also now seeing an economic crisis and having to live through an economic crisis, mainly because of COVID-19.
What do you think it says that in the middle of a global pandemic that the Nobel Committee decided to give the Peace Prize to the World Food Program?
Well, I think for us, it's critical that the world always recognize that one of the common denominators in all countries facing starvation, facing hunger, conflict is always there. 10 out of 13 of our biggest operations in the world, you can look at the violence and conflict that got people into a situation where they need our support, and they need our support to live, they need our support to get back on their feet. So for me, it makes complete sense. And I think, COVID-19 is a huge trial for the whole world, a huge test for the whole world. But, you know, there are 690 million people already hungry in the world today. And, you know, right now the World Food Programme is supporting 85 million of them. You know, there's a huge amount of work to be done. The fastest way to end hunger is to end conflict. But of course, as you've heard from our executive director, David Beasley, on an occasion, there is one vaccine right now that exists for COVID-19 ahead of any medical breakthroughs, and that vaccine's food.
That is Matthew Hollingsworth, South Sudan country director for the World Food Program, which today won the Nobel Peace Prize. Thank you so much again for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, sir.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today that a coronavirus relief bill is not likely to pass before the election. Negotiations have stalled as President Trump has repeatedly changed his mind about whether he wants Congress to pass a new stimulus package. Meanwhile, new unemployment claims remain relatively steady, more than 800,000 people filing their paperwork each week. Joining us now by Skype is Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and professor at Columbia University. Professor, welcome to Here and Now.
Nice to be here.
Well, you were a member of the Council of Economic Advisers, the chairman of it during the Clinton administration. What would you do now to respond to the economic issues facing the country?
I would have a major spending program. There are many, many people, bottom half of our population, that are extremely vulnerable. They live paycheck to paycheck, and for many of them, the paychecks aren't coming in. Unemployment insurance usually lasts for 26 weeks. 26 weeks have already passed since the beginning of the pandemic. And so unemployment insurance is coming to an end. And for in many states, the level of unemployment compensation replaces only a fraction of their income. There are also large fractions of the population that were left out in previous programs. Most important aspect is help to the state and local governments. You know, our state and local governments basically have a balanced budget framework, and their revenues have plummeted as the economy has plummeted. And among the largest group of newly unemployed are the state and local government workers.
What do you think about this idea of sending out another round of, in this case, $1,200 stimulus checks to Americans? Would that make much of a difference, do you think?
If it's targeted at the bottom, it does make a difference. We saw in the previous case that when those low-income individuals receive the checks, they actually spend it. And that means it provides a big stimulus to the economy. I think it has to be targeted because we are spending a lot of money. Previous packages were somewhat around $3 trillion. And that makes it all the more important that our money is going where it's most needed, where it will do the most good for the individuals and for the economy as a whole.
Well, let me ask you about that, because the national debt is currently more than $27 trillion. That is nearly the size of the entire national economy, the GDP. It is on track to exceed that next year. Are you concerned at all about that? Or is this a moment when we say, doesn't matter how high the debt goes, because obviously people are willing to buy our debt, and therefore we should spend what we need to get ourselves out of this recession?
Definitely it's the latter. We should spend what we need. Not spending that money is going to do an enormous amount of damage, which will be long-lasting. You know, when companies go bankrupt, they don't all of a sudden go unbankrupt when the pandemic is over. The damage is done. There's a loss of organizational, informational capital. It took us a decade to recover from the collapse of the stock market in 1929. It was really only World War II. And it took us almost a decade to recover from the onset of the Great Recession, 2008-09. We never got back to the level of government employees that we had prior to that recession. So this is a moment where we really need to do what we can to sustain the economy. No inflationary pressures, and that is usually the one thing that people worry about when they say, oh, we're spending too much.
Is there any amount that you think would be too much debt for the United States?
Not as long as we can finance it. And, you know, there's a curious thing going on right now. Basically, the Federal Reserve is financing the spending. And so we're borrowing the money. One hand of the government is borrowing the money from the other hand. So the net indebtedness held by the American people is really not going up that much. So, yes, if we were facing inflationary pressures, I would begin to get worried. But we also know that even if sometime in the future there were inflationary pressures, we have the tools to deal with it, both monetary policy that can constrain the economy and tax policies. We have a large capacity to raise taxes, especially on higher income individuals, and there is scope for more environmental taxes, raising capital gains taxes, actually taxes that would improve the performance of our economy.
So what if there is no relief package at all in the next several months, let's say even between now and January of 2021? What happens to the economy then?
Well, what we know is it's going to slow down. Already we see evidence of that. The recovery from the initial lockdowns will be slowed, maybe even reversed. What we're going to see is not the V-shaped recovery, but more like a U, or as some people call it, a K, where people at the bottom particularly are going to be having a really, really hard time. I also think one of the consequences is this long-term damage will make the recovery in 2021 all the more difficult. And that means we won't see a full recovery until 2022, 2023. So it will have long-term consequences.
Some people have talked about a W-shaped double dip recession and recovery. Others have said it will be K-shaped, meaning that the wealthiest will recover quickly and fully, while the middle and lower income Americans don't. What do you think the recovery will look like from this recession?
Well, the W reflects the fact that there may be a second wave to the pandemic. I'm very concerned about that. We have not put the pandemic under control. And obviously, if it increases enough, there'll be a second lockdown, and that will mean that we'll go into that W-shaped recovery. But the K really does capture a lot of what's going on in our economy. You know, there's data that shows that those at the top have been relatively unaffected. They can continue their work using modern technology. It's the workers in the restaurants, people who work in the airline industry, janitors in our schools, lower income people have been, and their families have been devastated by this. So that's why it is an apt description, the K, that the people at the bottom are going to have a hard, hard time. And the people at the top, actually, their savings rate in the second quarter was very high. They were not living paycheck to paycheck. That's really evidence that the people at the top are actually going through easy time. But it's not the kind of stress that the people at the bottom are facing today.
Mm-hmm. Professor Stiglitz, this pandemic has totally changed the global economy. No, for one thing, people can't really fly from country to country right now and do the kinds of business that they were able to before. How do you see our global relationships changing as a result of what's happening?
Well, I think there are two things that have become very evident. One is the need for global cooperation. You know, it's a pandemic. That means it's a global event. And the scientists around the world have really never cooperated more closely, more strongly in developing vaccines, the therapeutics, the tests. Unfortunately, some governments have not fully cooperated and some companies have not fully cooperated. But it does remind us about we share a planet and we need cooperation. On the other hand, the pandemic has also demonstrated the lack of resilience of our global supply chains. That means the global supply chains are going to be rethought and the nature of trade will be rethought. One of the things that bothers me right now, though, is that the developing countries and emerging markets don't have the resources that U.S. and Europe have to reinvigorate their economy. And that means the recovery in the developing countries and emerging markets may be very, very weak. And we're not going to get a strong recovery until we get a recovery through most of the world.
I just want to finally ask you, because you've talked about people at the lower end of the income spectrum and how much they're struggling. If somebody is listening right now who has lost a job during the pandemic and isn't able to make ends meet and is watching what's happening in Washington and watching that the two sides are unable to come together and offer more relief, what would you say to that person right now?
Well, I quite frankly, what I would say is this is politics. And one of the two parties is really fighting very hard to get money to you. And the other party is all of a sudden gotten fiscal rectitude. They didn't have that in 2017 when they gave a tax cut to the billionaires and the corporations. But suddenly now that it's the people at the bottom who need the money, they've gotten a dose of fiscal religion. So I say this is an election where your vote really matters for your future. Are they going to help the people who need it, or are they going to be fixated suddenly on the size of the deficit?
That is Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winning economist and professor at Columbia University. Professor, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
This week, President Trump has been putting a positive spin on COVID-19, despite getting the disease himself and despite the rising number of deaths in the United States. On Monday night after his return to the White House, Trump had this advice.
And one thing that's for certain, don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. You're going to beat it. We have the best medical equipment. We have the best medicines.
In another video released Wednesday by the White House, Trump said that getting COVID-19 was a blessing from God. And yesterday, during an interview on Fox Business, he said, "When you catch it, you get better, and then you're immune." It's been well documented that President Trump is a fan of the late minister Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote the bestseller The Power of Positive Thinking. Peale, who died in 1993, often talked about ridding one's mind of worries. But if he were alive today, would Peale be preaching optimism to solve a health crisis? NPR's Elizabeth Blair wanted to find out.
In his books and his radio show, Norman Vincent Peale talked about overcoming life's challenges.
What are you going to do with defeat? Are you going to let it defeat you?
This is from Peale's radio show, Live with Confidence, produced from 1967 to 1971.
If inside you were strong, then come what may of pain, difficulty, sorrow, or defeat, you can keep on going.
He preached a theology which also became his personal brand.
Kate Bowler is a professor of American Christianity at Duke Divinity School.
He would say things like, as you think, so shall you be. Or, quote, think positively and you'll set in motion positive forces.
President Trump, like his father Fred, was a believer. For some 50 years, Donald Trump attended services at Marble Collegiate Church in New York City, where Dr. Peale was the pastor. Peale officiated Trump's first wedding.
What little faith tradition Donald Trump appears to have comes almost directly from a long tradition of positive thinking in American culture. And so when he said, don't be afraid, I thought, yes, this is the typical impulse. This is the performance of invulnerability.
Vulnerability was a no-no in the Trump family, according to the president's niece, Mary Trump. She recently told NPR that her grandfather took Norman Vincent Peale's power of positivity, quote, to such an extreme level that it was toxic.
So my grandmother, with her osteoporosis, would come home from the hospital and need more care and physical therapy. And my grandfather was unable to tolerate it. You know, he'd be in the room with her, and as soon as she started, you know, showing that she was in physical pain, he would say, everything's great, right? Everything's great.
Given the gravity of COVID-19, it's okay to feel vulnerable and even afraid, says Dr. Michael Boss, senior minister at Marble Collegiate Church, where Norman Vincent Peale was pastor for 52 years.
Fear is just an indicator that there's danger, and there is danger with the virus.
Boss believes there is a side of Norman Vincent Peale that is often overlooked. He says Peale did rely on scientists when necessary.
Positivity doesn't mean that we can ignore the reality before us. It doesn't mean it's a substitute for exercising caution. It doesn't mean it's a substitute for action.
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Food doesn't just nourish and feed us. It can also be a form of political resistance and social critique. And no one knows that better than Nigerian chef and writer Tunde Wey. He made headlines with the Food Stand Project, where he charged white people and others more money for their meals as a means of paying for their daily privilege. Now, in the midst of the pandemic and the country's renewed call for racial justice, he's pushing for us to rethink how we eat. And he joins me now from New Orleans. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So Tunde, you were in the midst of traveling the country to document stories that we don't often hear in mainstream news or on food shows. And then COVID-19 happened and you decided to change course, releasing this series of Instagram videos titled Let It Die. And when we say let it die, we're talking about the restaurant industry. This is a controversial take. Why isn't it worth saving?
So I think it's important to distinguish, say, the industry from the people in the industry. I'm not advocating for, you know, people to be unemployed or destitute. So I think that conflation between the people who make up the industry and the industry itself, which serves capital and ownership, is one that I am trying to break.
In the second installment of your video essay, you talk with a New Orleans restaurant worker and rapper, and you all filmed that the day George Floyd died. You called the video the Holy War, and you say for many black and brown restaurant workers, it's a war that they've been fighting for a long time. This kind of gets back to what you're talking about regarding the restaurant industry versus the individuals who work in the industry. Can you say more?
The vulnerability of the workforce of black and brown folks in the industry has always been there. You know, if anything, COVID has made it worse because black and brown folks, indigenous folks, are more vulnerable but less protected. We want to delineate between a worker and a person as if they are not the same thing. The reason why restaurants are open right now is because the government doesn't want to fund an economy where folks are paid to stay home and be safe. So folks have to work. That is not a condition that we should memorialize by using words like frontline workers. It's terrible. Plaudits and praise don't keep people safe. And so nothing has changed. And I say that, you know, we are at the cusp of nothing new.
I want to talk a little bit more about the work that you've been doing to really illuminate this message. But I want to ask you about something that you wrote, and you said that you've been repelled by American food culture, which you found to be simultaneously intellectual and abstract. And what you see is that there is no morality here, meaning no relevant message or message period, just food on a plate. Can you explain what you mean?
So that sounds kind of harsh, but I want to say, because I've been accused by some folks of not really indulging in pleasure or enjoying food. And I love food.
Interesting.
I in fact, overindulge often. But and the way that we sort of run away from the reality of being constantly on the clock is to think of food away from its most basic property. So it's not what does it taste like, but it's how did it all come together to be here on the plate? How were the greens arranged? What sort of technique was used? It seems as if the more abstract the food can be, the better we are, or the better it serves us. I know there's a place for expression, and I know that food can be this place where we express ourselves, you know, as a form of art. But I think you can see parallels between the economic system and how we focus on speculation to grow capital. You can see that in the way we consume food and what is important to us. It's not necessarily how it tastes. It's more about the theater around the thing.
Your food and food experiences have always been a means to open conversation about inequities. I mentioned your food stand project in New Orleans and your dinner series in Detroit, Hamtramck specifically. As a native Detroiter, I had to shout out to that. I was born right outside of Hamtramck. You charged white people and others more money for their meals as a means of paying for their daily privilege. Why do you think food is a way to start having these kinds of conversations?
So I would say everything is a way to start having these conversations. I just happen to cook. You know, food is the place where so that people were receptive to my ideas. Also, food was a place where I found, at least in the mainstream, a dearth of these critical conversations and projects. So it's where I did it. I think that the probably most unassuming place for protests is the most effective place for it.
You also sold expensive hot chicken that ranged in price from $100 to the deed of a house for a full meal in North Nashville. I'm just wondering what were people's reactions to that? And in essence, really, who you're speaking to and hoping to reach with these food messages?
You know, I think in recounting some of my work, it sounds ridiculous. It sounds preposterous to sell hot chicken for a house. It sounds ridiculous to charge white people, you know, more for food. But like the audacity of my work reflects the scale of the problem. In North Nashville, the communities that I was working with were historically Black communities that were being pushed out by gentrification. You know, so the idea was, how do we secure affordable housing for Black folks who are maybe retired, who have a fixed income and who are being preyed on? So why don't we, you know, raise some money, buy their houses, put their houses in a community land trust and sell the homes back to them so they have the equity in their home, but they also have the security of affordable housing. And the way that I thought to do that was to sell hot chicken. So when I sold the hot chicken, I told folks what the problem was. Like, nobody was coming there to eat the chicken. They were coming there to like confront the reality of a city in Nashville that is rapidly gentrifying. And somebody bought a piece of chicken for like $100,000.
These instances are doing exactly what you're hoping that it would do. But how does this become a long-term, more sustainable type of model, or is it?
I mean, I don't think it is, because I was sort of like contemplating my work and I was thinking about what my success has been. And my biggest success, I guess, objectively, has been the amount of media coverage that the work has had. If you think about what we need, by we, I mean Black, brown folks, we need access to capital. Mm-hmm. The access doesn't exist. But what we do have access to is access to markets like the media market that allow for performance. So Black and brown folks, indigenous folks are consumed if they are performing, you know? And so my work is, in a sense, a performance that plays well in media spaces, because that is the only place where it is sustainable.
You mentioned your Nigerian descent, and for many years you lived here in the United States as an undocumented immigrant. How has your multiple identities and experiences here in the United States kind of shaped how you view food and its political nature in this country?
You know, we all live with fear. That's sort of, you know, a condition of life. But there's a certain sort of fundamental uncertainty that folks who are immigrants or folks who are never quite in their own place feel. It is not possible to live that way, to live with that sort of fear that breeds a certain kind of PTSD, that breeds a certain kind of anxiety, that breeds a dislocation. It's not possible to live with that fear and not have that taint how you see food, how you see the folks who make food, how you eat food. I know people, including myself, you know, we can go to a restaurant and when we sit down to eat, we're thinking and looking at the back. How many white people are here? How many Black and brown folks are here? How many of the Black and brown folks are in the back? You know, when you go out to our party, like how many black and brown folks are serving, you know, like that kind of thing. So when you sort of experience life a certain way, the whole thing can look like a plantation.
That's Tunde Wey, Nigerian chef and writer. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
President Trump's doctor has cleared him to resume public outings starting tomorrow. Social media has some thoughts about Trump going back to work after his COVID-19 diagnosis just last week. Let's start our weekly social media roundup there with Femi Ok, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, who joins us each Friday. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Jeremy.
Okay, so Trump goes back to work. What are people saying about this on social?
Well, there's a lot of real and also some fake doctors sort of analyzing when it was that President Trump actually got sick. So real epidemiologist Eric says it didn't say, and this is in the little note that the press secretary posted on Thursday evening, it didn't say since his first symptoms of a positive test. It says merely 10 days since his Thursday diagnosis, which means that maybe the president was sick with COVID during his first presidential debate. Mm-hmm. Dr. Liana Wen is stunned that the president's doctor says he can return to engagements on Saturday. That's 10 days, according to the White House. But if you're really sick with COVID and very infectious, you should leave about 20 days. And so there is this concern that maybe the president will still be infectious even when he's going back to work. From the president's fans, they're excited, they're happy, they can't wait to see him back on the campaign trail.
It'll be interesting to see, though, if they want to get anywhere close to him, given that situation. I guess we'll see if he goes out and does a rally this weekend. Something else I want to ask you about, Femi. Barbie, the doll, was yes. trending on Twitter on Wednesday after an animated video came out featuring her and her friend Nikki, who is black. What did they say, and why is this video getting so much attention?
So Barbie has a video vlog. And she posts regularly. And Nikki is Barbie's best friend, one of her best friends. And Nikki is black. And Nikki and Barbie sit down and have a conversation. And the conversation is really about some racism that Nikki the doll found when she and Barbie went off to do exactly the same thing. And somehow Barbie wasn't targeted, but Nikki was. And it's in very accessible language. And the reason it trended was because people weren't expecting Barbie to have conversations like this.
Well, and actually we have a clip here of the video where Nikki talks to Barbie about some of the times when she has encountered racism.
People did these things to me because I was black and they made the wrong assumptions about me.
And they don't make those assumptions about white people like me. And that's not fair, because that means that white people get an advantage that they didn't earn, and black people get a disadvantage that they don't deserve.
Femi, what kind of reaction are you seeing to this on social media?
People are impressed. Jen, for instance, says, "This is amazing. You're doing," that's Barbie, "what parents are scared to do. Thank you." Ryan says, "Incredibly valuable information shown in a format that is geared towards younger people and kids. Great to see." And I really wanted to get some kids' impressions. But if you go to the video vlog on YouTube, there are no comments allowed. But the audience that they're reaching, 9 million people on the Barbie YouTube, on Instagram, 2 million people. I'm sure most of them are kids. And so there's a big audience out there. And Barbie is a genuine influencer for young people. There's a little bit of skepticism. People thinking, yeah, they're just kids. They don't need to know about racism. And then a lot of pushback as well from people who think that actually, when you're a kid, this is the best time to learn lessons about racism, what is right and what is wrong.
Okay, one more thing I want to ask you about. And because you're Femi Ok, we always have to do something a little fun on these Friday chats. Early voting is underway in several states, Femi, and there are some clever digital campaigns popping up to get people to vote, including this one featuring naked celebrities.
Please vote.
Take your clothes off and vote.
Vote, vote, vote.
Everyone's voice matters in this election.
Please vote. America needs you.
It's easy for us to play this on the radio, Femi, because we don't have to censor anything. Exactly. We've got comedian Sarah Silverman in there, Chris Rock, Amy Schumer. Who is behind this and what are people saying about it?
An organization called App Represent Us, or Represent Us, and they are trying to get people to understand, how do you carefully, accurately do a mail-in ballot, for instance. Some states may have a double envelope. You have to use both bits of the envelope. Some states say you have to use a black pen. You have to use a black pen. You can't use a blue one. So the idea of the naked celebrities is basically it's clickbait, all right? These naked celebs have an important message for voters. Yes, I know you're going to click on it. A lot of people are just saying, why would you do this? It's awful. But it got your attention. It has been shared thousands and thousands and thousands of times. And Jeremy, I have a confession to make. I am doing this chat with you completely, totally clothed.
Same here. Femi OK, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, and keeping this chat PG-13 or even PG or G for that matter.
Absolutely.
Femi, thank you. Thank you. It's always wonderful to talk with you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Well, thanks to an internet outage at home, I am broadcasting today from my friend Michael Kelly's house in Provincetown, Massachusetts, with a beautiful view of the Atlantic Ocean. So thank you, Michael. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.